All right. Well, good morning again, Tuesday. Oh yeah, right, January 6th, 2021. That's not a dwell. The joys I take in January is that my book sales go up as soon as January 1st passes. So I'm like tracking. Ooh, look, I'm selling like 15 books every day. Isn't it great? We find happiness wherever we can. Greed, a little bit of greed, just to satisfy that little bug inside us. But I guess this is our first meeting of 2026. Did I even say 2026? I don't know. I was writing in the date down and I wrote January 6th, 2021, and I was like, oh no, that's not right. It is 2026. But just after a while, as some of the elders with me know, the year just starts to be such a weird number that you sort of like, what? It's what? Where? What? I mean, 1964, now that was something I can relate to, 1972. I mean, these are dates. These are real dates. 2026 is just fiction. It's something out of sci-fi, well, anyway, so we're going to start with about 20 minutes of meditation, and then I'm going to, as I mentioned before, I'm going to read something from Ajahn Amaro today. And then comment on it and see what your thoughts are. I'm just excited if you at all track the number of participants. We're at 48 right now, so if we could get like two more people, it would be like this goes along with my book sales greed. Like the more people come to my class, the more worthy I am. I'm winning the Dharma. The Dharma competition. Okay. Everybody knows I'm joking, right? I mean, joking, but in a real way. Like, there's ego. And then we try not to take it too seriously, which is why I'm laughing. Okay. That's enough said. So, yes, let's start with some sitting. And I'll try to calm down, and hopefully, you guys will be able to calm down. So just settling into whatever your sitting or lying posture might be. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Just feeling the body sitting, the body in stillness. And then the contrasting energy of the day, of your mood. Oh. So we begin a period of sitting. As I begin to sit, I often notice this sense that I'm almost moving forward through space, that the forward momentum of the mind is continuing on even as I begin to try to draw in the attention. Center the attention. And rather than trying to suppress that or push that away, just breathing with that feeling, that energy, that momentum, but feeling my breath with it. Breathing in. Breathing out. And so in that process, we are gently turning toward the breath and turning toward the present moment. Just feeling what is right now and feeling the flow of life. Breathing in, breathing out. The mind wanders and we bring it back whenever we notice. Attuning to the physical sensations, the sense experience of breathing. Typically, we point toward the breath, either at the nostrils or at the belly. Actually, two very different ways of feeling the breath, either feeling the touch of air at the nostrils or the movement. The diaphragm of the belly as it rises and falls with each breath. And so there is this rhythm. Breathing in, breathing out. Just exploring the difference between those two aspects of breath. It's one way to strengthen our mindfulness. Not just a vague idea of breathing, but specific touch, movement, felt now. What is it that pulls the attention away? Not analyzing that or judging that, but just observing. Where does the mind like to go? Where does the mind want to go this morning? Where is it being pulled? How is it being pulled? What is the energy of craving or the energy of aversion, wanting something, trying to avoid something? We're not trying to impose control on the mind. And yet we are trying to train the mind. That training works best when done with kindness and acceptance. So yes, we let go of thoughts, we guide the attention back to the breath, to the body. But we're also careful about the mental reaction to the wandering mind, to the feelings that are showing up. Careful that we're not being harsh on ourselves, not judging or piling on, but rather bringing an attitude of kindness, compassion, forgiveness for our humanness. Thinking is an expression of our humanness. How can we judge ourselves for being human? And it turns out that that attitude of kindness, openness, acceptance actually helps to develop more calm, more clarity. It helps us in our effort to be mindful and present. Judging ourselves or trying to control or suppress the mind doesn't actually result in more calm, but rather creates more agitation. Letting go is an act of kindness. Kindness toward ourselves. So I want to just first start by acknowledging that this is a significant time of year for a lot of people who deal with alcoholism, other addictions, food, and everything else. And so despite my attempt at humor around, oh, my book sales go up in January. It's a cycle that I've seen many times, and I know it reflects something real, something larger out there in society and in our culture. And it's always interesting to see these bigger trends reflected in something as simple as the book sales of somebody. And the radio, I hear some story about Dry January, and there's an article in the Times I came on that was, five signs you might have a problem with drinking. No, don't ever give the impression that I don't take this seriously. But there is a way in which, when you watch the cycles, and this will be my 41st year of sobriety, watch these cycles over and over, that there's something, predictable, and that can, you become a little bit jaded about it. So I hope that everyone here is doing well, and whether you're, in your first day or your 50th year of recovery, that that today you're okay, and that you take care of yourself in the ways that you need to. Because no matter where you are, and even whether you're an addict or not, we need a lot of self-care to survive this crazy world. So I noticed there were a couple of things in the chat. Did Monica, did you see this thing? The person saying they wanted the
Yeah,
link.
I'm getting ready to respond to
Okay,
it now.
thank you. Thank you. Oh, the walkthrough of peace. Yeah, I've been seeing things about that. Thank you, Tanya. Following the monks on the walk for peace through the South has cheered me up. The reception has been wonderful. The majority of people coming to see them are not Buddhists, but they're enormously moved when interacting with the monks. Many are in tears. The reception in Decatur was so big the police closed off streets. Senator Warnock spoke. Oh, it's so beautiful. And then, of course, I saw the terrible thing that one of them got hit by a car and lost his leg, and was like in the hospital, like, "Hi, I'm a happy monk with one leg." Like, okay, good on you. Thank you for sharing that, Tanya. I had been seeing some pieces about that. Remarkable. I promised I was going to read something from Ajahn Amaro, and this is, the Abhayagiri Anamaravati. This is an Amaravati book. I had to look, and it was published in the spring of 2021. So, right, really a year into the pandemic. And it's called The Phenomenological Approach of the Buddha. Just some light reading, right? Ajahn Amaro, if you don't know him, he's the abbot of the Amaravati Monastery in England, and he's the former abbot of the Abhayagiri Monastery in Northern California. He was a co-abbot most of the time there with Ajahn Pasano. An Englishman with quite a lot of charm and wit and brilliance. A very intelligent, bright guy with a very deep practice. He ordained as a monk at the age of like 22 or something, and he's now, well, he's 6 years younger than me, so that makes him 69. So he's been a monk for a long time, almost 50 years. So I'm using interim glasses right now as I get my having my final, hopefully final, cataract surgery tomorrow. So this is from the book, as I said, the Phenomenological Approach of the Buddha. I imagine it's there's probably a download of it you can get on the Amaravati website. I haven't looked that up, but this is a section called The Terror of Undefined Being. If we explore the nature of experiencing any phenomenon, we may notice that when the feeling of identity arises, a me who is frightened, a me who is in love, a me who has a problem to solve, something in the heart likes that feeling. Even in an uncomfortable state, such as anger or fear, the feeling of I am of a defined being is something the mind locks onto and relishes. A feeling of deep gratification arises, even if the experience is, on its surface, ostensibly unwanted, like a problem, a difficulty, or a struggle. Something in the heart says, phew, now I've got something to be. Whether it is in relation to sense pleasures, excitement, aversion, indignation, fear, doubt, or bewilderment, the mind works in the same way. It may be that we get a thrill from transgression, doing something we are not supposed to. It may be that we feel most alive when we are afraid of being caught, or when we are angry with someone, or when we are in a state of jealousy, or simply complaining. I think it was when I read these sentences that I started to go, oh, wait, now he's getting to me, right? It may be that we feel most alive when we are afraid of being caught, or when we are angry with someone, or when we are in a state of jealousy or simply complaining. On the surface, these might seem to be unappealing states. Who would want to feel that way? But the fact is that these are not uncommon experiences. Some people make a career, or at least a lifestyle, out of finding fault with others, being enraged about injustices, or hating themselves for an unforgivable wrongdoing, or pursuing vengeance for a perceived wrong. He might not be landing on every possible state, but as you're listening to this, I imagine if you're following, that like me, when you read this, it was like, oh yeah, there are some times when I kind of like, I just want to like, yeah, that feels really alive. The mind tries to find a way of sustaining, feeding, or repeating that feeling of defined being. You might wonder, why do I keep getting into arguments? Or why do I keep finding things to worry about? From having watched my own mind, I would say it is because of that sense of defined being. It's an unusual term, defined being, but he's trying to capture something, right? Find a term for it. People often habitually fight and complain because they feel most alive when they are letting somebody have it. They look for an argument just so they can sustain that thrill. We may constantly put ourselves into certain situations because that's when we feel most alive. I mean, this is so, to me, resonant, obviously, with addiction. Why do I keep drinking? But really, with any kind of like emotional pattern, right? Like, why do I do that thing? And particularly, if you have deeply ingrained patterns that keep showing up, that you keep being like, why do I get into these situations? Like, it's just because it creates this sense of safety of being alive. Let me read some more. So here is an example that may be familiar. You're wrapped up in some kind of task, and when you finally complete it, there is a moment of relaxation. You plunk yourself down on the sofa and say, thank goodness that's done. But after a few seconds, a deep disquiet arises and you start looking for something new to do, or something new to be, or something to exist in relationship to. You then realize that you have other problems or tasks to tackle. That's right, I've got 10 emails to answer, or I've got that lawsuit with my neighbors, and a somewhat bizarre feeling of relief arises. I get this is, one of my versions of this is, it's January. I have to start working on my taxes because I have very complicated taxes because of all the 1099s and stuff. So, and I have to get all my travel, and it's like, oh, great. I have something to do for the next 2 months. Oh, God. A bizarre feeling of relief arises. The pleasure chemical in the brain gets released. Ah, fantastic. I have a problem. I have another genuine thing to worry about. There's a me and a thing for that to push against. Phew! When we look closely, we may discover that what we are terrified of is undefined being. We feel we need to be something. I mean, we know this in meditation, right? You're meditating. It's like, why can't I quiet my mind? Because if your mind stops, it's like you stop. In terms of wanting this sense of defined being, the more unsatisfiable the aim, the better. A love that can never be requited, something broken that can never be repaired, a goal that's always just out of reach. These are experiences we can get really obsessed with. We feel a perverse relief in this because we are guaranteed to always have a goal that can never be reached. Having that goal is enough to define us, and if it is unobtainable, we will never be betrayed by that yawning chasm of, so what? As Marilyn Monroe sang in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, random reference. When you get what you want, you don't want it anymore. If I gave you the moon, you'd be bored with it soon. For myself, I have found it very interesting and liberating to look at my various obsessions and fears. I spent a huge amount of my life being worried. I was an Olympic class worrier. It was so normal to me, I didn't even realize I was doing it. I only later realized that being worried was something I did to make myself feel like I was someone, that a worried me was much more desirable than an undefined me. This was a big revelation. So examine your mind, the feeling, field of experience, the things you fear, the things you hate, the things you love, the things you think you are. Test your mind to see if what I have been saying has any validity or not. Notice the effect of that examination. What is the value of that exploring? How does it change the way the mind relates to sounds, sights, tastes, ideas, memories, fears, visions, obsessions, unrequitable loves, unforgivable wrongs? Maybe there's a particular obsession that has been precious to you, but when the grip on it is released, the heart is instead encouraged to delight in that undefined quality. With that relaxation, the heart says, oh, what a relief. Allow that change into the heart. See what a difference it makes, because that kind of spacious relief is completely different from the superficial gratification that comes with clamping onto some defined sense of being. It is the profound relief of the heart free of grasping, free of identification with anything, natural, limitless, selfless, bright. You may discover that in a heart free of such obsessions and self-view, the world is a lot more spacious. So I just found that to really, really hit home. If you just watch your mind on a daily basis, and that's one of the tasks and one of the benefits of practicing mindfulness in your daily life is to notice what do I keep reproducing? This isn't just about like learning to meditate well and getting concentrated, or having moments of peace, but starting to see like, oh, I build my own life, my own experience of reality through this need to feel alive, right? And what is it that makes me, quote, feel alive, unquote, if you will? You know, what Amro is saying is that actually, if you stop trying to, be someone and be something or feel alive, that you will actually be more alive, that spaciousness. And many of us are familiar with that, having touched into those places at times. But they're very easily lost because we're deeply conditioned in these ways. And so, a lot of our practice is to keep looking and keep seeing where we get hung up, where we get stuck, where we repeat ourselves. I've mentioned this probably a bunch of times that, like, some years ago, I started to notice, it was particularly when I was traveling a lot for teaching, I started to notice how I would plan on packing the packing of my suitcase for weeks in advance of a trip. And it was just this same thing. It's like, oh, I've got this thing to worry about. And when I'm thinking about it, then it feels like there's a me that's accomplishing something, that's doing something, that's asserting its presence in the world. And boy, when he talks about how we get attached to, like, negative mind states, anger, right? That's a really familiar one for a lot of us. Like, wow, and it's true, when you're angry, you really feel like it's very, very alive in an unwholesome way. But, is that what we want our life to be? Do we have such a need for just this delusional sense of self that we're willing to attain it through suffering, through acts that create suffering in us? So, I mean, even as I say that, I think, oh, there's, like, another potential judgment slips in with that, like, oh, I shouldn't be this way. So I'll just step back and say, I don't think any of us are ever going to be able to break completely out of this conditioning. This is normal, again, human, and just what humans do. And when you are conditioned to think and behave and relate to the world in certain ways for many, many decades, and that's backed up by kind of your DNA, by the evolutionary imperative of being, of being alive, of being someone, then, you're not going to just, oh, I see this, I have this insight, I should stop. And, oh, that person, that guru over there, doesn't create self, so I should be like them or something, some nonsense. It's like, no, just maybe see if you can turn it down a little bit, maybe let it go a little bit, maybe laugh at it a little bit, maybe not just, and as addicts, again, addicts in recovery, we've already taken a huge step in this process, because addiction is one of the most pernicious forms of selfing. Just, needing to feel alive, like when I'm drunk, right? When I'm stoned. And so, not to judge ourselves too harshly, to see that actually we've done some significant work around this, and that it's ongoing. And many of us know that already. The reason this resonates, I think, for people, certainly for me, and I hope for you, is that it's familiar. It's not like, oh yeah, I never thought about that. I never noticed that I have these habitual patterns. Of course, we notice that. And as people in recovery, again, because addiction is the most pernicious form of habitual behavior and and conditioned behavior. Having broken out of that, we have this at least intuitive and very likely quite conscious awareness that repetition and self-destructive habits can be dealt with, can be worked with. Our kind of our journey in life, a big part of our journey, not to let it become like this job of like fighting it all the time, but just that it's something we're interested in. It's something we've seen the importance of letting go, and so letting go is part of our whole journey and how to, part of our orientation towards our lives and towards the world. So, but I think it does help to read something like Ajahn Amaro and kind of really zero in on that, because for me, part of that is seeing that there are these bigger things like our addiction, but then to see, oh yeah, there are levels and levels and layers where this conditioning happens that are more and more subtle. And so I can work on whatever, level I'm able to right now, whatever is standing out for me. And, and he says that towards the end of that, to kind of make this like a regular contemplation, just to notice, oh, where am I going? What's my mind doing right now? What are the things that I'm, the cycles I'm kind of putting, getting trapped in and repeating. And again, like, a period of, well, maybe not again, but when we meditate, we put a particular spotlight on this, and so it's a particularly useful time to not just try to get rid of your thoughts, but to notice, oh, look, wow, that's why I say, like, the suitcase packing thing was something I noticed in meditation. I was like, I'm meditating, and every day I'm sitting here thinking about what clothes I'm going to wear when I go to, Boston in 2 weeks or something. And the weather's going to be different. Do I need to go shopping and buy, do I have the right socks, And so, we all have these things, right? These fears and judgments and projections and plans and regrets and all of it. And just to see which ones, what's standing out for you. And what it's progress, not perfection. One of the great phrases of the 12-step literature and 12-step tradition, that to like, and the question then is, what can I progress on right now? We can't take it all on at once. We can't deconstruct the entire ego system in one go. We have to just take, well, what's up right now? What's showing up for me? And I think that is something many of us probably, I hope, do kind of as part of our daily practice and our daily reflections. Like, where am I getting caught right now? Where's my negativity showing up? Or where's my positivity, my delusional positivity showing up? I don't have that problem. But I hope people find this as valuable a reflection as I do. And so I thank you for your kind attention, and open it up to comments. And thank you, Monica, for finding the book there. So you can, I'm not going to click on it right now, but I presume that means you can download it as some sort of ebook. It's quite a good one. Vicky, go ahead. Thank you.
Yep, the icebreaker. So yeah, this was great. And then I'm because I do I'm a to overdoer. I mean, yeah, that's a place. Yeah, definitely a place. And also, there are these abbots and teachers, and monks who teach, and people who are really like totally generous, and very busy. I mean,
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, not, you know, maybe busy is the wrong word.
Well,
Maybe there's another word for it, you know, that's less about, you know, less freighted with dukkha. You know, it has more space to it. I don't know what that word might be, but maybe you do.
Well, I think of the phrase from the Metta Sutta, unburdened with duties, and you know, having just as you said, seen many very busy monastics, I had to reassess what that meant. It didn't mean you don't have duties. It means that you're not burdened by them.
Yes. Okay, great. Yeah, like that fear of financial insecurity will leave us, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
Exactly. We still don't have any money. We're just not afraid.
that. Yeah, the bill is still sitting there
Yeah.
unpaid.
We're just not panicking.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. But the, yeah, I mean, and you know, sometimes I have the fantasy of just, you know, telling the people in my various orbits that I'm done. Sorry, go find somebody else. You know, and I'm you know, just like go off in a hole, and then I'm kind of like, oh my gosh, you just need to take a nap.
Well, sometimes I'm like that too. I'm like, oh, I should just like take a couple months off from teaching. And then immediately I get depressed because it's like, oh, wait, I love to teach. What am I doing? You know, it feeds me, you know, and it's like, yeah, but is it, are we burdened by it? That's the thing. Can we,
Okay, yeah.
yeah.
And then one more thing. Devoted practice with no yearning for results, you know, no expectations, no goals. And then your thing, the heart free of grasping. Yeah, I just, you know, they're very inspiring little sound bites, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's it. Happy
Yeah.
New Year too. Yeah. Jeez.
And I mean, you know, it sounds like such a big thing, like the heart free of grasping, but it's not like, oh, I have to completely disengage my heart from grasping ever again. It's like, no, just in this moment, I can be not grasping. And then I'll worry about the next moment when it comes, you know. Thanks, Vicky. John, hello. Been a little while since we've heard from you.
You've just been answering all my questions as they come up. So,
Oh, okay.
so one thing I wanted to make sure I understood. So, he's saying that the place to be is the undefined sense of being. Is that correct? And that
Yes.
if we're consternating about tasks, we are in the defined sense of being.
Right.
Is that accurate?
Right. So the piece is called The Terror of Undefined Being. So that we have this fear of not having something to hold on to. I mean, you know, it's called self, but it's like, in another way, it's kind of like purpose or meaning or, you know, what, you know, doing. You got. Did you mean to mute yourself again?
No, I was just not didn't have anything to say. It was that was what I
Oh.
just wasn't clear was that the undefined sense of being is where the terror is,
And
that
so,
you're grasping to define yourself by doing
yes,
things.
to give yourself some meaning and identity. And I don't, I will personally say, I mean, I love the piece, but I don't find that turn of phrase to be the most evocative one out of the piece. It's not, it doesn't quite, but the rest of it, so to me, is pretty clear what he's getting at, particularly when he talks about like being attached to like anger or lust or, you know, planning and fear and all these things that like, oh, right, like, yeah, when I'm in the shower and I'm like, you know, oh. You know, rather than just like, oh, what happens when I just like feel the water? That's okay, you know.
Well, I like what you said or what he said about test your mind. I think that's a good thought to kind of keep, keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Other thoughts, comments? Hello, Christine.
Hello. Thank you for that reading. Very powerful. So I had two thoughts. One was I've been noticing recently that my mind really craves certainty. I think the word for that's control, but it really likes certainty. So I too will start way in advance to calculate even conversations. I just replay them over and over, the ones I haven't had yet, over and over in my mind, so I can be certain. And how addicted, if you will, to certainty I am. And what I hear in this is the space is the invitation is uncertainty. And in so many areas of my life, that is happening right now. And the more that happens, the more I really like to think about certainty. And then the other thought I had when you were talking about addiction was, when I think about addiction, I'm still wanting a me, but I'm not wanting the me that I actually am.
Right.
So the addiction is trying to create a different me than the one that's actually present. And anyway, those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Christine. It's so true, you know. Yeah, if I could just be somebody else, then I'd be fine, you know. The also something you said reminded me, which fits into this whole theme of the term "don't know mind," which comes from the Korean Zen tradition. It's sometimes called great doubt. So, rather than thinking that you know what's going to happen, or even as you're saying, like controlling what's going to happen, having this attitude of "don't know." Like we always think, like, "Oh, well, after this class, I'm going to dot dot dot," and it's like maybe not, you know. And when I'm, if I think I know what's going to happen, then I often ignore what's actually happening because I'm tied up in my mind instead of being present for the experience of what's happening. And then when something happens that I wasn't planning, then it's like disruption, right? Like, oh no, like, oh, this is terrible. It's like you don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. Takes courage to actually live like that. Tanya, hi. Thanks for the story about the monks.
You're welcome. Yeah, that really has given me a lot of comfort to see that these Southern Baptists being so happy and excited to see them. But on this subject, I think for me, the danger is in trying to not have that identity thing of becoming too disconnected. You know, I have to be careful to still feel connected
Right.
to people and to surroundings into the world, but not be so caught up in what about me? And I noticed the identity thing a lot more when I'm retired now. So in my career, when I was more competitive and more of a high achiever, you know, this was a huge problem for me. And when I retired, it was so hard to let go of that identity. You know, for a long time, I had my former title was the first thing I had in my Facebook page, right? It took me years to move that way down so you don't really see it, you know, because there's so much identity in that. But just real quickly, one of my favorite memories of my daughter, she was about maybe 6 or 7, and someone asked her what she wanted to be when she grew up. And she just got this look of bewilderment, you know? And she
Great.
said, "Can I just be myself?"
Wow.
And I thought, you know, this is the result of growing up in a 12-step slash Buddhist atmosphere,
Mm-hmm.
where I encouraged her to be a C student. You know, it's like, don't, you know, it's okay to be a C student. You don't have to have that stress and burden of being a straight A student, you know. Anyway, yeah, the identity thing is a tough one. So thanks. That was a
Yeah.
good teaching today. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Thanks, Tanya. Well, really lovely to hear people's thoughts and, this.
Oh,
The dar
great.
Oh, somebody was saying
Yeah,
something.
it's Mickey. I
Mickey,
can't find any
oh, yeah,
buttons.
Mickey, hi.
I can't find any buttons to press because of
That's
the
okay.
thing. So I have to. Thank you, Kevin. I have not been able to come because they've been doing construction in the wall behind my
Oh,
head.
God.
My
I'm
house is
sorry.
starting at 7:30, so I've really missed. I've been meditating, but not. This brought me right back. This was a really wonderful thing. And I too have a packing obsession. And I travel a lot to different climates. And I never in all this time never thought about it the way you framed it today. It's like just so I mean it was like this whole thing about identification and you know like creating like I think I don't create many problems anymore because I have a very pleasant and pretty simple life. But I clearly I don't because I'm in my suitcase a lot of the time or on
Right.
aisles of Trader Joe's. So I thank you for reminding me about not where I should be, which is where I'm generally, but where I am, which is
Yeah.
I'm very grateful for being reminded that this is a human condition, and I am not at fault for
Right.
having a mind that does what it does. It's a matter of making friends with it,
Yeah.
and for me, one of those ways is trying to diminish my expectations because I
Yeah.
really am uncomfortable with disappointment. And since I have no control over the outcome of so many things, if I stop expecting things to be different from how they are, which is a challenge. It's just a goal for me. It's like one of those things I can make myself try to do. You know,
Yeah.
it's like another way to. This is was eye-opening for me, Kevin. So thank you so much, and I'm happy
Yeah.
to see you, and Happy New Year, everyone.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Well, and what you're saying kind of brings me back to Tanya too, like the middle way, like if we can't, just do nothing, we're engaged in the world, and one of my solutions to the packing issue is to remind myself that where I'm going also has stores. I'm going to New York next week, and I'm like, if I need some other socks, there probably will have some in New York. So,
On the corner.
yes, exactly. I just have to like trip over the store that's got it. All right, everybody. Thanks. I will be here next week as usual, and next Tuesday night I will also be at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. So for anybody who's in the Bay Area who would like to see me in person, I will be wearing a different pair of glasses, which could really be exciting. So
This was
presumably I will have a
tremendous.
different lens in this eye, and
Oh,
all sorts of excitement. So
this Friday is your spirit rock, too.
that's right. Thank you. The second Friday is coming very early in the month. So Friday at 6 p.m. I'll be on Zoom for Spirit Rock. So I hope to see some of you at
Happy New Year.
any of these things. And yeah, Happy New
Kevin,
Year.
my husband just went through the whole cataract thing, and it's great. You're gonna
Oh,
love
yeah.
it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's so far so good. Yeah,
Good.
it's
At some point, you
perfect.
won't even need glasses, Kevin.
No,
That's awesome.
I will. I chose to get the type that require. I actually like, I've been wearing glasses since I was 11. I'm not ready to go without them. I feel too naked.
I wish I would have done the same thing, but I didn't. So now, anyway, thank you for everything.
Okay.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. I am gonna have a meeting with Paula. So I will say goodbye to everybody else. At some point, I will eject you if you do not.